Welcome to Keep Making Movies, the podcast where we explore, shall we say, movies that may have needed a bigger budget. We evaluate the movie for what it is, decide if it could have been improved with a budget, and if it'll join our Keep Making Movies official recommend list. I'm your host, KJ, and with me is...
Tom.
Today, we are deviating from our normal exploration of micro-budget films and taking a look at B-movies from the 50s. In this case, William Burke's Pier 23. This is William Burke's 75th feature-length film of somewhere around 90 or 95 movies. Pier 23 is made up of two stories where we follow O'Brien, a guy that can be hired by good men to do things that good men aren't willing to do. In the first one, O'Brien is hired to collect a man from the pier who has just escaped prison. O'Brien decides to let the escaped prisoner run a quick errand before bringing the convict to the priest, but unfortunately, O'Brien gets hit on the head and the convict dies. Turns out he wasn't a convict, and O'Brien has to go through a string of people to unravel the mystery of who is killing who and why. And in the end, he seems to not go to jail and everything's kind of fine. Second story, O'Brien is hired to collect an envelope after a boxing match. Turns out the boxing match was rigged and one of the boxers was set up to die. And again, O'Brien has to figure out exactly what happened or wind up in jail himself.
It was a wrestling match, wasn't it?
Oh, wrestling, not boxing.
Yeah, because you get that great analogy of there's as much blood in a wrestling match as dye in a monastery. Dice in a monastery?
That's dice in a monastery, yep.
Which I couldn't figure... So there's not a lot of blood in a box in a wrestling match? Is that the...
I'm assuming, yeah, it's a comment on how wrestling's fake. Is kind of okay. What I took it to mean. Which is weird because, you know, I was always told in the 80s we were supposed to believe wrestling was real, but then in the 90s it was okay to believe it wasn't. Mm-hmm. But this was from the 50s.
So I guess it was. I guess it goes back and forth. I guess it was okay to believe it was fake in the 50s.
How about now?
I have no idea.
Oh. So directed by William Burke. So Tom, what do you think the goals of William Burke, the other people making this movie, what do you think their goals were?
First of all, I'm going to say, I think this is more producer-led than director-led. And the producer, Robert L. Lippert, who had his very successful... what we call B-movie company in the early 50s. Really, he had an early company in the 1940s up until the mid-50s when it basically got sold out by Fox, when he sold it to Fox. He seems to be more the creative push than the director. The director seems to be a stand-in for guy who can call action and cut and what have you. I think the goals of the creator then is to generate a sort of serial style detective noir that could be replicated over and over again. Create a character, an archetype like an O'Brien, who you can rely on to excite people, sort of like a Sherlock Holmes, but a tough guy version of Sherlock Holmes. And you can make a movie pretty cheaply. You could get people in the seats to watch that movie. And you can make a handsome profit on O'Brien serials. I think that's what his goal was. In terms of the plot or what have you, I mean, it's entirely derivative of every single noir. I mean, the language seems almost AI generated, even though I know they didn't have AIs back then. But it's clearly, it's something you could pick up really quickly. You could replicate it really quickly, and you can create a sort of franchise out of it. I think that's what his goal was, to create a franchise. I don't think he was successful. I mean, he wasn't successful. We just had this one movie in the O'Brien thing, but that's what I think the goal was here.
So do you think it was a passion project? Do you think?
No.
No. Okay.
I don't. Sorry to cut you off. What else were you going to say?
No. Yeah. Okay. So I agree that it... Well, and according to that article we read that we talked about last week, a lot of times it was, you know, use whatever's around. So I also agree it wasn't a passion project just due to the nature of how these things came about. So that makes it pretty different than a lot of the season one Keep Making Movies.
Yeah, this was an attempt on his part. and on that studio part to kind of move from a what we're calling a B movie, which is something that stops existing technically in the 1950s. It's the movie that follows an A movie. Usually you get a double feature. This is something that was predominant in America in the 1930s and 40s. It stops happening after the famous court case that said movie studios could no longer own their own theaters. It kind of broke that apart. That also sort of ended the double feature B film. But you had a lot of independent studios trying to do this. And I think this is trying to make movies. And I think this movie is part of a trend with this producer to kind of jump from B's to A's. I think he's looking to make mid-level. I think he's looking to raise the budget. I think he's looking at this point to transition from super low budget to medium budget.
So an A minus or a B plus.
Exactly. Yes.
Instead of an A movie. Mm-hmm. I want to throw one more thing. I think the other goal, and maybe this is kind of what you're saying too, but another goal is to hold people's attention for an hour. I think that's why we get some of these wonderful phrases and lines. And that, we're going off topic here, but the other thing that I found interesting is this felt like two episodes of a TV show, right? This could have easily, in fact, I think they did eventually recut it and air it on TV. I wonder if TV had as much to do with killing the B movies as anything, because all of a sudden the cheaper produced stuff went to broadcast television instead of following the A movie.
Yeah, that was a big thing. And I think it was the audience changed. The audience that would go to a B movie in the 1930s, when that's all there was to do, and when they had air conditioning, that was very, very nice, because that would be the one place that had air conditioning, they now would be able to stay home and see something of equal quality without buying the ticket. And once studios couldn't control the release schedule in theaters, which was the case before that Supreme Court case, they could put these B movies in there pretty easily. They own the theaters, more or less. And then with the advent of television and the fact that they lost their theaters, yeah, you didn't have B movies following A movies. And like you're saying, right, that stuff goes to television. And this is super television friendly. And I know the producer looked towards television and produced things towards television. Lippert did that. And so that seems part of, it's a really good point on your part, that seems part of the design of this is, how can we make something episodic? Maybe even how can we make something in a theater that can also be recut and put on television, right? Mm. Repurposing the same product.
Right.
I don't think this is like artistic passion at all. This strikes me as pure entrepreneur commercial. How many ways can we sell this?
Yeah, I agree. So how do we think they did with the money they had?
I think they made serviceable entertainment. I think, I don't know how funny or parodic they expected it to be. It comes off at times almost like a parody of The Maltese Falcon. The dialogue is hilarious. The plot, it's the second plot I even stopped following. It doesn't exactly make sense. Mm-hmm. But what you're going with is, you like the main character. He has this kind of old-fashioned tough guy sensibility. It's perfectly easy to tune in and turn your brain off. And so I think with the money they had, I think they did perfectly well. I think if you increase the budget, the expectation would be such that, you know, you'd have to have one plot that's 80 or 90 minutes or 120 minutes. I can't imagine watching one of these plots for 120 minutes. I think it would be miserable. Mm-hmm. So in fact, I think the constraints and this sort of, hey, let's look towards television as a model, that type of thing, that can be the new money maker. That I think made this perfectly fine to watch.
Yeah, I agree. If there was a series of these, I could imagine getting into it as taking a break mm-hmm. from some more serious movies, right? A 30-minute following O'Brien on his little adventure of the day, where you know he's going to get knocked out a few times because it's got to service the plot.
He does get knocked out both times. He does. And wakes up with a dead body in the
all
room.
The time. And the cop shows up right after. Right? Like it's it's almost like the audience should be cheering when the cop, like when that happens. Like it's very predictable. It's like watching Teletubbies or something. It's it was therapeutic, to be honest. It was it felt good by the end of the second one. Should we spend some time and go over some of our favorite phrases in the
Oh yes, we should. Let me bring up my list here. You boys couldn't track an elephant across a basketball court.
The pier was as deserted as a warm bottle of beer.
His mouth hung open like he wanted you to drop a suggestion on your way out.
That was the best one. I brought that up at dinner tonight. That is such and the poor dude is on the couch with his mouth open. I was just picturing O'Brien putting in a little thing like, stay alive next time, but like and a drink for O'Brien. Something cheap but impressive.
He just sat there waiting, like a guy feeding arsenic to a rich ant. Yeah, I got a date to take a fish out of the bay and teach him to walk straight.
What do you read? Tea leaves on the side? No, insurance reports.
Are you doubling for Gabriel?
What was that one?
That was when the when he goes to intercept the guy at the pier.
Oh.
And he's like, I'm watching out for you. What are you, doubling for Gabriel?
Bill lay down slowly, like a man afraid to get his clothes musk. Then the pink drained out of his face and reminded you of a salmon that missed the last jump. Yeah, they were so good. And there were so many, right? It was...
Yeah, it kept going. There's some of them that, like, this one, I don't know what it means. All some people get is unhappiness. They wear it like you wear a sports coat, only they never seem to get a new one. They don't get new unhappiness. It's just this. It's the same unhappiness.
You know what might be fun if, like Tarantino or somebody made one of these as a 30-minute.
Yeah, that could be fun. I think that was sort of his intention with the Grindhouse feature, where he's looking at these sort of 70s B movies, which are very different in terms of their style and their audience appeal. But that's what he was doing, right? He's trying to replicate B movies in an A movie frame.
Did you see his Grindhouse movie?
I didn't. I mean, I got the idea, but what did you think of them?
They were super fun, and I could see how they are from this tradition. I can imagine connecting the dots from Pier 23 to a schlocky 70s, low-budget film.
And it's this producer was the first distributor of the first Roger Corman film back in 1954. So Roger Corman is like the king of the bees. He ended up making a bunch of these kind of horror, low-budget horror B movies. Really one of the great independent filmmakers, but it's schlock, right? It's B-level stuff. He was really good at finding talent. And so Martin Scorsese trained under him, Francis Ford Coppola, Jack Nicholson. He found a bunch of these talent and he was really good at it, but he never spent any money. He was really, really good at making a profit, which is what sort of unifies all these different eras of B-movies is you have to make a profit.
You're bang for their buck.
We are selling something, exactly. And I think his way of doing that, Corman's way of doing that was, there was a number of ways, but I think he just had a really good eye for talent. And if you could get somebody who's just starting, but is really brilliant, there you go. That's a way to make some money, yeah.
So speaking of money, do we think a budget would have helped this movie?
I don't think so. I think that the fun of it is probably generated from its constraints, right? That sort of energy of we're trying to break into the mid-level, but we still have this entrepreneurial, we need to turn over a profit type idea. So I think that more money, I don't know what they would do with it other than expand one of these plots, which I think would have ruined it. It wouldn't have made it more fun. I don't know.
It'd
what
probably
do you think?
Be less quips, right? It would have gone through more drafts, they would have been like, "No, we're not saying this over and over again."
Yeah,
I agree. I don't know that money would have helped, or it would have gotten it closer, maybe not to literally to Maltese Falcon, but it would have gotten it closer to an actual noir type movie. And again, I think then it would have just been lost to time, right? I mean, it kind of was lost to time. I don't know, has anybody heard of Pier 23 before we brought it up? But I don't even think it would have made these, the reason we picked Pier 23, it was the first movie that came up when I did a search for B movies. So we didn't seek it out. We were throwing darts at a board here. And I don't know if it would have came up if it had more of a budget. I think it would have got lost in more of a shuffle than it already has.
Yeah, the major studios were releasing a lot of films, and we haven't seen most of them. They just go away. And this movie wouldn't have been made if it was put on the A frame, right? If it was made by a major motion picture, if it was made by like MGM or something like that, they wouldn't have never made it. It would just been, this isn't good enough for our genre, which is now moving into 2 hour plus films with major stars and whatnot. So I think if you had a larger budget here, you push the movie from kind of low mid budget to high budget, and at that point, who's going to make this, right? For a million plus dollars.
Another thought I had while watching it, it feels like a movie that they would put on in another movie. So if somebody was at the drive-thru, this is what it would look like. Or even in Home Alone, right? The movie they made up for Home Alone.
I know.
Get your no good keister off my property. Like that
you
movie.
You filthy animal.
Like this had that feel to it, right? This could have been thrown right into Home Alone, right into another one of these movies. I don't know why, but it had the feel of a fake movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the B movies do. It's imitating every, I mean, this is the thing with the movie. It's imitating every single cliche of a noir. And Maltese Falcon, I think, is about as conventional a noir as you can come by. I think it's also an extraordinary movie. Conventionality, I just mean in terms of a standard noir, not in terms of how good it is or not. And this movie imitates all of it. It has like the lone tough guy. It has the clippy dialogue. It has the loose women, the kind of femme fatale women, the easy way with guns, you know what I mean? Like it has all of that in there, even the relationship with the cops.
And twice. They do it all twice.
I mean, even the cop relationship is right out of the Maltese Falcon, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. The cop always shows up at Sam Spade's house and he's, one day you're going to be in cuffs, Spade. He's like, you know, they're basically the same thing, except nobody seems to know how to pronounce this guy's first name in this movie. Did you notice that? They mispronounce his first name differently.
No.
It's either Dennis or Denis.
Oh, wow. Well,
they pronounce it
because they're all very Irish, right? And that was the other thing I noticed.
Oh, maybe is it like Danny, like D-E-N-N-Y?
Is that Danny Boy? Is that Denny Boy?
I guess it's Denny Boy.
Mr. Yeah, Denny O'Brien, you know.
In French, you say Denis. Right? That's like how you would pronounce Dennis. It's
okay. Not,
you know, like Denis Villeneuve is the director. So that's what I thought. I thought they were like, oh, he has a French first name. But then people would say Dennis also. I'm like, I don't know what's going on.
maybe they wrote the script and it had both in there sometimes, sometimes they wrote it one way, sometimes
they left the S off, and right? And the actors are like, I learned this in 5 minutes, I can't change.
Our typewriter, the S wasn't working when we wrote that part of the script, so Denny, I get it is. So what do you think, Tom? Does it make the list? Does it make our official recommend list?
Yeah, I think so. And I think this is a lovely little trip back in time that connects to the other films we've been doing, which the current B movies seem to be these like low budget sci-fi experimental things. And these B movies are not about independent, necessarily single filmmakers or whatnot, but like independent studios that are trying to just churn and compete. They're trying to build businesses. And it's so it's a completely different thing, but it's also working in the same tradition as these contemporary science fiction movies that we've been looking at. And so I think it's a little gem. It's a delight. I think you could watch it once, and that's probably it. But yeah, so I'm going to put it on the list.
I'm going to disagree. It's a no from me. I loved it. I thought it was wonderful, but I don't think it's in the spirit of keep making movies. I think the goal of keep making movies is to try to connect with the director to understand their passion more, where they're not mm-hmm. restricted by anyone telling them what to do. They're only restricted by money. And this is kind of the opposite. They're being told exactly what to do, and then they're just trying to profit as much as possible from it. So it's a no from me. So it's up to you, audience. Let us know on social media if this should stay on the list or not. We have a disagreement amongst the co-hosts. We're at Talking Studios, wherever you want to, social media. In the meantime, maybe we'll check out some of other William Burke's movies, or even Robert Lippard's movies. That might be another fun way to explore. I don't think either of them are around anymore, but if they ever did come back, keep making movies, guys. Like, I would watch another O'Brien movie.
You can rate and review this show anywhere fine podcasts are available. For those viewing in YouTube land, if you haven't already, please like this video, subscribe to the Talking Studios channel for all our exciting content, and follow us on social media at Talking Studios. Check out other shows by Talking Studios, including Talking Pictures Trivia, where we explore movies through trivia, Limited Lexicon, where we play through text-based adventure games, Get the Point, where we slowly reveal a movie poster and try to guess which movie poster it is, and Adapt It, where we explore adaptations in various forms. Got a question for us? Call the Talking Studios hotline at 201-467-8679 and leave a message. It may be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Keep Making Movies wherever fine podcasts are found.
Join us next time when we discuss an early United Artists movie, Kiss Me Deadly, from 1955. Stay tuned for our first impressions of Kiss Me Deadly.
Wow, Talking Studios.
Next week, we'll be discussing Kiss Me Deadly from 1955. Tom, how was your watch?
I really enjoyed this movie. I thought after the first scene it was going to be very silly, because the first scene where he's driving down the road and he has to avoid Cloris Leachman isn't well shot. The reverse shots don't really match. And so I thought, oh, this is going to be camp fun. It turns out that this movie, even though it's not of the quality of something like The Maltese Falcon, is still startlingly good. It looks amazing. There are scenes that you realize why the French New Wave like these movies so much. They look like something you'd see in a Truffaut film. It's absolutely gorgeous. Some of the acting is, especially from the lead, we can talk about. I think it's a little blank. You really do need a movie star to kind of fill out that role the way Humphrey Bogart did in Maltese Falcon. But I thought the movie was really, really thrilling and interesting to watch. Even if a lot of the plot elements become kind of confused, there's sort of a mess of characters who are informing our guy Hammer. Yeah, so besides some kind of plot messiness and some performances that are a little either too blank or over the top, I think it's definitely worth a watch. And you can see the influence in future films. How about you?
You know, I hadn't heard of this before we brought it up for the show, Tom. Kiss Me Deadly, have you heard of it before we brought it up?
I haven't. I know Mickey Spillane and I know Mike Hammer. So okay. I know the author okay. and I know the character.
Character, okay.
I know who Cloris Leachman is, but I wasn't familiar with this particular iteration. And I was surprised by how popular this movie was in France. Before watching it, I looked it up, and it has a big, big effect on the French New Wave. Wow. But, well, that's kind of weird. But then when watching it, it makes a lot of sense. Its aesthetic is very, very similar.
So this is a United Artists movie. And I couldn't even think of off the top of my head, like I wouldn't have been able to identify a United Artists movie. So I had to look it up, but they did City Lights, Night of the Hunter, The Apartment, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the latest Bond movie, maybe all the Daniel Craig Bond movies. I'm not sure. Licorice Pizza, which is a newer movie. So they do a pretty wide. But audience, you know, I'm really not sure you're supposed to focus on this movie while you watch it. I think it was kind of made that you should be on your phone, because like you were saying, Tom, the plot doesn't quite add up. Like there's certain parts of the plot where they either forgot to film something or didn't film something. It does not connect. It doesn't work. They also repeat themselves if it's something important. So if you're on your phone and you hear something twice, that's the part you got to remember. And the end, slight spoilers here, it doesn't really matter at all for the whole kit and caboodle. So audience, go enjoy this movie.
I think the ending matters. I'm going to really? Disagree. Yeah, I think the ending is... Okay, we'll get into that.
We'll get into that next week, audience. Check out the movie, see if you think the end matters. And so right now you can find this on Internet Archive. It might be on YouTube, but I don't think it's on any of the major streamers.